Hello and welcome to the interview from IMD. Today we're speaking with Didier Cossin. Didier Cossin is the Chaired Professor of Governance and Finance and Founder and Director of the IMD Global Board Center. He works with owners, boards and senior leaders to help them improve organizational performance through best-in-class governance and decision-making. He also holds the UBS Chair in Banking and Finance. Welcome, Didier.
Thank you, Jonjo. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Didier, you have recently written a new book on boards. It's called High Performance Boards. I want to just start off with a very broad question. Why did you write this? What brought you around to this subject?
This edition is actually a second edition of this book, which is frankly a very pragmatic and practical manual of governance. A lot of people have ideas about governance and concepts, but few people can land it really effectively with their own board or building a board or even aspiring to be on a board, understanding what this entails. I wanted something very concrete, very simple, very practical, but complete enough that even senior board members could use it.
Okay, so you're talking about the complexities there, but also the practicalities. What is governance and why does it matter for those who are coming into this without such a specific understanding of governance?
So, Jonjo, there is a lot of confusion actually about the world. Many people confuse governance with compliance, and this is not what this is about. Governance is really the art of decision making at the top of organization. Governance itself is a word that comes from a word that means the rudder of a boat. Is how you do you decide the direction and how do you make the directions at the top of organization. That's why the major actor of governance tends to be the board, but sometimes it's frankly a combination of the board and the executive team, sometimes a combination of the owner and the board, and sometimes other bodies as well. But the board is very central at large to quality governance.
I love that term, that phrase, the art of decision-making. That's what governance is. I think that's a far more compelling way of describing governance than some might think of it. What, in your view, makes great governance? What's come out of your research and what are you finding in this second edition of the book?
So first, frankly, there is a lot of theories around governance, but I don't like that very much. I think, you need to have something very material, very simple, and very practical, whether it's a family board or whether it's a publicly listed company board, whether it's a school board or whether it's a philanthropic organization board. There are some principles that are quite simple. And I've grouped them into four pillars, what I call the four pillars of high performance boards, the four pillars of great governance. Number one is simply the people. It's not only the composition and the skills of the people, it's also their diversity, of course, and diversity of perspectives, but also their dedication. And do they have clarity of focus? Do they pay attention to the right things? The second pillar is really the information. And on information, you may have great people. If they don't have the information, the decisions are not going very far, right? And so it's about internal information from the organization, but it's also external information on context. Sometimes it's informal information, and sometimes it's very formal information, the pack that goes to the board. Sometimes it's information that's completely independent from management. I remember Stephen Lee, for example, the chairman of Singapore Airlines, having breakfast with the union leaders to understand, how the union leaders were perceiving the difficulties that they were confronting. And so this is a kind of informal information that can help a board also decide better. The third pillar, structures and processes, is a long list of structures and processes such as the audit process, the strategy process, the risk process, the nomination process, the onboarding process. All of that makes a great board secretary, frankly, a terrific asset for the board. And the fourth pillar is really the culture and dynamics. And how do you work as board members together? Are you more of a team? Are you more challenging or more supporting to management? What is your relationship with the executives? And frankly, that's highly tuned to the chair's style. And so culture and dynamics are frankly a very important dimension of board performance. So four pillars, right? The people, the information, the structures and processes, and the culture and dynamics of the board itself.
When looking at four pillars these four pillars of people, the information architecture, systems and processes, and culture. Is there one pillar that's perhaps more important than the others? Are they of equal importance?
It's interesting, right? Because I find that governance is a bit like health, right? What do you want to watch for health, right? You want to watch your weight, you want to watch your blood pressure, you want to watch your cholesterol level, you want to watch maybe even your mental health, right? And the reality is that everything is a bit holding together and you need to work a bit on everything all the time, right? Is this about meditation or is this about exercise, right? Yeah, we probably need a bit of both, right? And somehow, you know, on governance, it's the four pillars matter. The four pillars are necessary. If you have one weakness in one of them, frankly, it could hurt your governance big time. But I do find that at large, today's boards are quite decent in terms of the people. You have a big division in culture. You have some very proactive and positive boards. You have some that are fragmented and fighting. I do find at large that information is not very good. It tends to be copy-paste and not very well-tuned. And the structures and processes depend a lot on the size of the organization at large. And larger organizations have settled that. The smaller organization just costly and takes time to establish. And so I would say today, boards are quite decent on people at large, divided on culture. Information is weak, structures and processes okay for sophisticated organizations, not that good for smaller organizations.
I want to come around to board failures shortly, because I know that, you know, in one section of your book, you're talking about the four pillars of board effectiveness. In another, you're talking about the four areas of board failure. But before we move on to it, can you tell me a little bit about how you landed on these four pillars? I know you're the originator of this idea.
Yes, and it's very, very simple, right? I was involved with boards, you know, as a young man. Actually, some of my PhD research in the US was already on boards, despite the fact that I started in finance and in financial markets. By the way, I think investors have a lot of information and a lot to give to board and to board reflection at large. And so I combined a bit two elements. But overall, right, I started understanding the complexity because it has so many dimensions. It has psychology is an important driver of board quality, but the legal environment as well, economics too, control as well, right? So there are so many theories involved that I needed something in which I can talk to a chair, I can talk to a board member, and I can assess the governance very fast, whether it's for an investment, or it's simply to help the board, or simply potentially even to get on the board itself. And this framework, these four pillars, is a very simple way to be complete enough, right? And to figure out pretty much everything can fit into these four boxes. But if you forget one of the boxes, you have a good chance of having a big hole in your thinking. And so it's simple, but complete.
Let's go through some of those areas of board failure. You know, I mean, as much as we like to hear about the successes, I think there's a fair few people that are just as scared of failure as they are open to succeeding.
Of course, it's amazing. I mean, these governance failures are all around the world. And frankly, I'm not only talking about the Wirecards or the Ubers and all of these big failures, the Volkswagens and the Fukushimas and all of these, right? And the sports organizations and so many of these board failures. What I've been struck with, right, is that you still have many organizations where you have a fine-tuned executive team, a board that is not that good, and the organization does fine. Huh? And so I wanted to see, okay, if I have a bad board, but my organization at large is fine-tuned, do I have a problem? And yes, you have a problem in four dimensions. Huh? First is what I would call technical risks, the big risks that can hit you. You know, your exposure to a COVID crisis or your exposure to a geopolitical change, right? And these are typical of where boards act as secure bees and are fulfilling their role as a board. So technical risk is one area of failure. Another area of failure is, frankly, every organization is challenged today on strategy. I mean, strategy as a plan is not working very well anymore. There is a lot of flexibility in the context, in the environment. Technology can be disruptive or it can be a huge value add. You have some substitutes that are arising to your activities that are unexpected. And so there again, you know, the board can avoid the blind spots and can elevate itself. And that elevation of the board and the lateral thinking that the board brings with many different experiences, if it's fine-tuned, is a big asset to the company. And if it's not, frankly, increases the chances of strategic failures massively. The third dimension is simply that there has to be a level of trust between the executives and the non-executive members of the board. So there has to be a relationship there that is productive. And yes, the word trust is the right one, but it's a strange trust, right? Because everybody knows who fires whom. Everybody knows who decides on the compensation of whom, right? And so it's a trust with that, with tension. And you have to figure out how to land that well. And then the fourth area of failure that, frankly, I pay a lot of attention to is integrity. Because there are integrity failures in the corporate world, but in all of, even in philanthropic organizations, even when money is not at stake, there are big integrity failures and conflicts of interest that are present out there. I have seen money circulating in brown envelopes for the nomination of a president of an international organization. I have seen committees being created to survey what competitors are doing rather than figure out the work of the board itself. So plenty of conflicts of interest out there. And I have seen some people being on boards just for self-interest at large. While this is frankly a role that can be a true social elevation for individuals, but it requires a lot of personal integrity.
In your experience, having worked with so many different firms, different boards, at various different levels of governance and with companies to help them with their governance, which one of these areas of failure, as you put it, is hardest to kind of broach? Which is the area where people are most resistant to changing themselves? And the reason I ask this is because, you know, it's a very interesting mix what you've got here in both of these four pillars, right? You've got a mix between the technical and the slightly softer skills areas, the areas where, you know, you're not just dealing with giving somebody a checklist of things they can practically do, but things that they're going to have to practically do about themselves, which I can imagine takes a certain diplomatic delivery as somebody advising.
Yes, this is well spotted, John Joe, and it's quite ambidextrous, right, to be a board member. It's interesting that myself, right, I was studying mathematical economics at MIT at the same time I was teaching French poetry at Harvard. And I've noticed that somehow this combination of minds I find back in many board members that allows that lateral thinking and the two sides, the technical side combined with what I could call either more philosophical or more psychological side, which both are very important. And frankly, I think the harder side is not the technical side. The harder side is, for example, relationship between executive and non-executive. Frankly, this is an art to land that well. Or the integrity side, truly figuring out what's conflict of interests and what's integrity. I find boards have an easier time to move on risk and on strategy if they have the rational thinking of understanding their past ways have become obsolete, because that's the other dimension. We live in a world of natural selection for organizations. And many of the current processes of boards, many of the current ways of boards, notably on risk thinking, risk identification, and risk appetite, are obsolete. Many of the ways we're doing strategic thinking one day a year in a strategy retreat doesn't make sense in a world that's fast moving. And so all of these processes somehow, if people are willing to open their brain to it rationally, I think the technical side can be bridged. as long as people are hardworking enough, because that's another dimension. Many boards, you know, the board members are just not prepared enough. They don't commit enough of the work. And board is hard work. I mean, I estimate it takes about 20% of your time to do a good board membership. That means 5 board max, right? And so there is that commitment of work behind that some board members, because of the past ways of boards being a bit of a social type of network, right, are not committing to. But if people commit to work, I think the hardest is the psychological or the philosophical side.
We've talked now about so many different aspects of success in how to run a board, how to be a board member. I'm interested in how influential or not influential boards can be, right? I'm talking about the link between governance and performance. Can you talk me through how strong that link is in your view and whether or not the strength of that link changes from industry to industry, or if you've seen it between company and company?
It's massive. And I can explain that in many different ways. First, what does governance do? It does 2 things. It reduces the downside, right? You avoid the bad CEO nomination. You avoid the fraud situation. You avoid, you know, the poor acquisition, right? Typically, so you reduce the downside. The other aspect of governance is that you increase the upside. So, for example, you choose a better strategy. You adapt to the changes of the world. You evolve the culture of the organization towards, for example, a more agile culture or a more innovative culture. And so governance tunes, if you want, the distribution of performance in 2 ways: reducing the downside, increasing the upside. But you see that concretely in the markets in many different ways. First, I mean, there are big actors of governance. They're called activists. And activist hedge funds have been the highest performing of the hedge fund categories over the last 10 years. So this is important to realize, that's concrete returns. Second, I'll tell you, I have my own model of governance that is invested in the US stock market, in the S&P 500. We have beaten the S&P 500 by 40% over the last 5 years. Only investing in governance, no other criteria, no other selection, and with a well-diversified portfolio of 100 stocks over 500 stocks, right? But I also can give you other examples, which is sovereign wealth funds and their engagement with their own assets, or simply private equity firms and how much they are paying attention to governance. I had the leader and owner of one of the massive private equity firms of the United States that was recently telling me that all the success they have is linked to governance. I had actually the prime minister of a G7 country recently telling me that all his personal success was linked to governance, and he's also a big investor himself. And so it's quite intriguing, right? Governance is an engine of performance once you conceive it the way I've described, right? That art of decision making.
So there's a very broad range of areas you've mentioned there. You've mentioned the application of governance in private industry. You've mentioned it in terms of governance on a sort of national level, international level, to do with organizations. And I'm sure this would also apply to third sector organizations, charities.
Very much so. Very much so.
It kind of leads me to think about what the future of this area is. We live in this world which is constantly adapting, and business today looks incredibly different than it does 20 years ago. How is governance going to change, and how is it changing with the world today?
It's a great question, right? Because I'll give you my view. That's more personal view, but I've been right a few times before. It's the advantage of turning my age, 60 years old, right? So I have a bit of experience. I've been around. And my view today is very clear, right? We're coming into a world of conflicts. It's not only geopolitical conflicts. Yes, it's going to be geopolitical conflicts. We've entered a Cold War that may be becoming warmer, right? The US-China conflict. We have entered, you know, many local conflicts, of course. But it's not only these geopolitical conflicts, it's also conflicts of values. You have the pro-ESG people and the against ESG people. And suddenly, you know, these two groups cannot talk, right? It's very hard to go from Texas to Palo Alto, right? Somehow the views and the identities have actually transformed and changed. And I'm quite concerned by the ability of organizations to navigate these conflicts. And I think that's going to be a defining moment, which requires several things from boards. And you understand, it's conflicts of identities, conflicts of values, conflicts of principles that we have more and more in the world. And by the way, a degradation of authority within that. And because people are questioning authority once they are questioning identity and values. And so that means that for board, I see more engaged board. The basis of board in the past is constructive dissent. It's a dialectic process, right? The discussion, elevating each other to smarter decision by engaging around that dialectic process, right? I think, frankly, this is still true. Huh? We still need that. But we also need boards that act as a team, that can be more aligned, that can be more powerfully engaged around the organization. And within that, maybe aligned around same values. For example, I think very hard today for an energy company to have half the board that's pro-ESG and half the board that's against ESG, right? You have to figure out your camp somehow. I think it's very hard for an organization to say today, I'm going to be aligned to the US and to China. If you're a tech company, I think you have to choose your camp, right? And so somehow you're constituting a conviction of where you want to be, and you have boards that still have some constructive dissent, that still have some dialectic, but also agree some elements on some elements of identity and engage powerfully for transformation around these elements. And frankly, we're going to a world where we will need highly engaged organizations, powerful organizations. And this is true for philanthropic organizations. This is true for international organizations. This is true, of course, for the corporate world as well.
There's two sections in your book I'd like to get to before we conclude our conversation. One is crisis management. I'll leave that for a moment. The first, though, I'd like to get to is risk-taking. You're talking in terms of practicalities already. You're talking in terms of, you know, tech companies need to choose China or America. Boards have to find a way of choosing whether they're going with a certain value or without a certain value, because you can't actually do both. You can't have your cake and eat it.
That's right. That's right.
Can you talk to me about some of the practical guidance you'd give to a board member when it comes to risk? Any advice for an aspiring board member who was hoping to be in this position? How should they approach risk?
Yeah, very good. I'd say two things, right? First, I think any board today need to have a crisis preparation. I think today, in today's world, every board is exposed to crisis. And frankly, it's not beyond any board to do a bit of a simulation, a bit of an exercise. And many boards do it. Not enough. All boards should do it. But, you know, simulate a cyber attack, simulate an activist coming in, simulate, you know, a disruptive board member, simulate, you know, a competitor moving in sharply, right? Simulate the Chinese invasion, whatever you want, right? Simulate a topic that somehow touches the board member emotionally, stresses people. You have to figure out the board weakness, right? Where, and so if you're a bank and you're overprepared on cyber attack, please don't do a cyber attack. Do maybe a sexual harassment case that becomes, you know, front page in a paper, right? Or do something, a fraud from your CEO, right? Figure out something that where you think, oh, shoot, what do I do on this one, right? Because that's where the preparation is helpful. When the guts are distorting you and somehow it's really hard to find that reality of the good judgment. Crisis in Greek means judgment. And crisis is a good time for judgment. And so figuring out that ability to make the right judgment under stress, so you need to figure out for your crisis preparation these stressful times. And the other thing I would say is, as a new board member, don't rely on legacy risk preparations. You know, organizations have all their risk system, the enterprise risk management, ERM, and all the others. Don't rely on that. You have to have your own view of risks. You have to have your own perception of risk. And you have to figure out the board's risk appetite and communicate that well to management. And so as an organization, and any size of organization can do that, I want my board to have its own view of risk that is unrelated to management's view of risk. And I insist on that because management has typically a horizon that's maybe 3 to 5 years. If it's a new CEO, it may be shorter than that, right? And the board should have, in my view, 10 to 15 years. If I'm on a family board, it's my next generation, it's 25 years. If I'm on a sovereign wealth fund board, it's probably the next 50 years. And so I'm figuring out a longer term horizon. And for that, my risks are necessarily different. So I want my board to think risk by itself and not only approve the risk view of management. Of course, management needs its risk view. But as board members and as a board, you need to have your own risk views.
What I'm taking from everything you've said there, both for longstanding board members and newer ones, is that board members need to be prepared to put themselves in uncomfortable positions, to actively look to make their own life as a board member slightly uncomfortable in the short term, to make sure they're prepared for a future that could really become quite difficult quite quickly.
Very true, John Joe. And I would add to that that there is no good governance that's comfortable. Exactly like there is no diversity that's easy. If it's easy, it's not diversity, my friends, right? And if it's comfortable, it's not governance, because you need that tension. You need that dialectic process. You need the constructive dissent. There has to be something of a tension in you, which basically lands on your personal integrity, on one's personal integrity, because you have to be able to elevate. Of course, it comes with smart, it comes with psychology, it comes with many other dimensions. But at the end of the game, right, you need to be there as a person, not with others' principles, but with your own principles and your own integrity, and be able to defend your choices within the group that is the board, and creating with that group a body that becomes a secure base to the organization at large.
Didier, this has been a fascinating conversation. I know we've spoken a lot already about the kinds of people this could help. When you were writing this book, the first and the second edition, I'd be interested to know who you thought you were talking to and who is this book for, who should be reading this, because it seems as though, from what we've been discussing, this could be a book for the Narendra Modis and the Donald Trumps of this world, all the way down to people on a slightly less grandiose scale, but still working in some kind of governance scenario. Is that an accurate representation of the kind of people that you think could benefit from this?
It's quite a wide range. You're right. And I've had, you know, the chair of Nestle, of HSBC that have read it, and many of the board members of large organizations. But frankly, the board is for anybody interested in governance. And what does that mean? And how do you do it concretely? And again, it works for a school board. It works for, you know, a church board. It works for a little foundation. It works for any type of organization. But the principles are the same. And it can be a very solid support to a large publicly traded organization, or for private equity asset, or for a sovereign wealth fund. And many ministers around